My name is Roger Stone, and I'm an agent provocateur. Yeah, I live a pretty Machiavellian life, and I'm a skeptic. I tend to believe the worst of people because I understand human nature. Human nature has never changed. That's why one of Stone's rules is that hate is a stronger motivator than love. That's because it is.
Roger Stone, longtime Republican strategist and political advisor to President Trump, speaking in a Netflix documentary there about his life. Well, Stone is in court today for the beginning of his long-awaited trial tied to the Mueller investigation. We'll get updates on that later in the show. First, one of the key witnesses in the House impeachment inquiry has changed his testimony. Gordon Sondland, Trump's ambassador to the European Union, now admits that U.S. military aid to Ukraine was tied to investigations President Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, wanted the Ukrainians to conduct. Sondland's revisions were laid out in transcripts released today by the House committees overseeing the inquiry. For more, we're joined now by Rosalind Helderman, political investigations reporter at The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more about what his revised statement says.
Yeah, this is pretty incredible. So Gordon Sondland was one of the first witnesses who testified behind closed doors. And he had said publicly, and I think in his testimony as well, that he did not remember ever laying out a quid pro quo with regards to military aid to the Ukrainians. So he didn't remember having said to them, you know, you're going to have to open these investigations into this company connected with Joe Biden's son or into the 2016 election. To get military aid. But then what happened was other witnesses came in and they said that they did have that memory, notably the former essentially acting ambassador, Bill Taylor. I'm sorry, I think he's the current acting ambassador. Mm-hmm. He testified that on September 1, he came to understand that Sondland had in fact warned an aide to the Ukrainian president that the security assistance would not come, that additional military aid would not come unless Zelensky announced these investigations. And so what has happened today is that we've learned that Sondland actually revised his testimony to say, yeah, maybe he did say that.
Well, he was under oath when he made the original testimony, right? So could he now be on the hook for lying to Congress?
I believe he said he didn't remember having said it. Okay. So there's always that kind of wiggle room. Yeah. I think the more important part is just the fact that we now have this really key player involved acknowledging that, yes, there in fact was a quid pro quo, and he made it clear to the Ukrainians. He told them, you are not going to get this military aid, this desperately needed funding that had been appropriated by the U.S. Congress. They had voted to send this money to Ukraine, and he told them they were not going to get it unless they opened up these investigations of the president's political rivals.
So was he told by President Trump to say this? Is that explicit in there?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So he is continuing to say that he was not explicitly told that the quid pro quo was in place by President Trump, but that by early September, he could think of no other credible explanations for why the military aid continued to be held up. So that when he made this statement to the Ukrainians, he had just presumed that that's what they needed to do to get the military aid. And that's a pretty important point because it does give some sort of layer of insulation to President Trump, at least in the telling of this one witness, and there are many others, who is basically saying that he didn't know for sure that this was something that had been ordered by the president.
And so far, has the White House said anything about Sondland's revised testimony?
You know, the testimony just came out a little while ago. I have not seen a comment from the White House, but I wouldn't be surprised if we do get one.
Meanwhile, there is Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman are associates of Rudy Giuliani's. They were arrested last month at Dulles, apparently with one-way tickets to Europe. First of all, remind us, they're accused now of some campaign finance violations. And Lev Parnas now says he's open to talking before the impeachment inquiry. How would he figure into this inquiry?
Yeah, he's actually a pretty key player. So Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, these two businessmen from Florida, were kind of Rudy Giuliani, Mayor Giuliani's conduits to Ukraine. They were connecting him with people in Ukraine who said that they had dirt that Giuliani wanted to hear. And so they know a great deal about sort of the timeline and history of how this project began, how Giuliani became interested in it, the information that was going to Giuliani, also the motivations of people in Ukraine who were connecting with Giuliani, what it was that they wanted out of this. And so they could be very powerful witnesses. There's also the fact that Lev Parnas' business, the business with the great name Fraud Guarantee, paid Rudy Giuliani $500,000 right in this time frame for security advice. And so Parnas is going to know all about how that came about and how that those payments were structured. So he could be a very important witness. The one caution I would offer is he's not sharing his information yet. His lawyer has offered some indication that he might be interested in talking to Congress about ways Lev Parnas could cooperate. But, you know, those are always negotiations, and it may be that what his team is after is immunity granted by Congress, which would make it harder for him to be prosecuted in New York for the charges that he's already been indicted for.
So, the campaign finance problems.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've seen this movie before where people express who are under indictment or under criminal investigation express a willingness to assist Congress, and it doesn't always come out that way.
So President Trump says he doesn't know these guys at all.
Right. And what we understand from Parnas' lawyer is it was that comment that really upset Parnas and made him willing to open these negotiations with Congress because, you know, he says, the lawyer says, any sentient being who reviews the public record would know that that's just not true. The men spent quite a bit of time together. They attended a bunch of events together. We actually just reported for the first time this morning that Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman were among just 13 guests at a small roundtable dinner attended by the president in April of 2018. We know the president spent about an hour and a half at that dinner. So the notion that the president doesn't know them at all is sort of not supported by the public record.
And photographs of the two of them together.
Yes, multiple photographs of the two of them together at various different events over the past year and a half or so.
Right. Okay, so it's possible that Parnas will talk before the House impeachment inquiry. We're not sure exactly when that could happen. We've talked about what that might mean for the investigation. What does it mean for Rudy Giuliani in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a particularly sort of ominous sign for Giuliani. You know, of course, they have to know something that would be hurtful or damaging to him, but they do know a great deal about him, a great deal about what he's been up to in Ukraine and in this country. They spent a lot of time with Rudy Giuliani. They traveled around the country on private airplanes. They dined together frequently. They went to cigar bars together. These two men know a lot about Rudy Giuliani's activities over the last year and a half. And so if they believe that they have an interesting story to tell, that could be hurtful to Giuliani. We also know that Giuliani is under investigation himself by federal prosecutors in New York. And so, you know, if there's any chance that these men have any knowledge that could lead to criminal liability for Giuliani, their potential willingness to cooperate could be a very bad sign for him.
Well, Rosalyn, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Rosalyn Helderman, political investigations reporter at The Washington Post. Remember Roger Stone? Well, he's back. The white-haired, Nixon-tattooed friend and political advisor to President Trump headed to court this morning for his long-awaited trial. It's one of the last lingering threads from Robert Mueller's two-year investigation of Russia's interference in the 2016 campaign. And like everything else in Stone's life, this trial is expected to be a circus. Already, there's been some drama. Prosecutors tried to introduce a clip from The Godfather Part 2. A key witness wants to bring his therapy dog into court. Byron Tao is with us now. He covers the DOJ and the FBI for The Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay. Remind us who Roger Stone is and what he's accused of here.
So Roger Stone is a longtime Republican political consultant, a self-described dirty trickster, and he's long been pretty close to Donald Trump. He served as a lobbyist for Trump way back in the 80s and the 90s. He's sort of been at the fringes of Republican politics for a long time. He's worked on and off as a political advisor for Trump, including very early in his 2016 campaign before they had sort of a falling out. But he stayed close to Trump and has remained a confidant and sort of a wise man as Trump's political career has advanced. And earlier this year, Stone was charged with several counts, pretty serious charges, including lying to Congress, witness tampering, and essentially is facing could face a pretty long prison sentence.
What was he charged with lying to Congress about?
So all this relates to a congressional investigation that sort of paralleled the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Congress was asking questions about his interactions with the website WikiLeaks, which had published some damaging emails from the Democratic Party in advance of their convention to try to embarrass the Democrats there, and also later published some of John Podesta's emails, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. And Stone is alleged to have lied about his interactions with the website and some of the communications he had around them. That is a federal crime, and he's about to go on trial for that.
So he is accused of acting pretty much, I guess, in essence, as a mediator between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign. Is that right when it comes to these emails?
That's right, or it's essentially a back channel in some ways. Uh-huh. There were several attempts at outreach from Roger Stone to try to, get information about forthcoming releases. Stone heard things through the rumor mill and used sort of intermediaries to try to get to Julian Assange, who is the founder of WikiLeaks, and a number of other people close to WikiLeaks. And so House investigators were obviously very interested in any nexus between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign, and Stone is alleged to have not told the truth about those interactions, and also tried to coerce one of his former friends, Randy Credico, into lying before Congress.
So that's the intimidation of a witness charge that they're talking about. That?
That's right. There's some text messages between Stone and Credico. Credico's long suffered from anxiety, and he's had struggled with addiction. He has a little white therapy dog named Bianca, and at one point Stone threatened to take his dog away from him in sort of a menacing manner. I believe he even threatened to kill him at one point, although, with Stone, there's some level of hyperbole in a lot of these statements. And prosecutors say that was an attempt to intimidate Credico into lying in his own appearance before Congress.
But what is Credico's involvement in all of this, in the WikiLeaks, in the emails, any of it?
Yeah, so we're deep down the rabbit hole here, but essentially Credico is a radio DJ and sort of a liberal personality in New York. He had some contacts with people that knew WikiLeaks and was vaguely involved in some of Roger Stone's capers, and was also of interest to congressional investigators. And, there's some text messages between Stone and Credico where Stone asks him to pull a Pantangeli, I think that's the name, essentially a character in the Godfather who lies to a congressional committee, which is why the Godfather clip argument came up in court. So that's the heart of the witness intimidation charge.
Okay. So I guess the prosecutors lost that battle. They're not going to be able to play that clip in the trial.
Yeah, so they're going to be able to discuss the scene itself, but they were hoping to actually show the clip from the movie, and the judge, I think, thought it might be a little too prejudicial to show a clip from a mob film and believe that they could make their point without actually showing the clip itself. So they'll be allowed to show a transcript and describe the scene, but we will not get a showing of The Godfather Part 2 in court.
Well, it should be pretty entertaining anyway, right? What happens in this courtroom. Steve Bannon is going to testify too, right?
That's right. There's a whole host of characters. I mean, we don't have a full witness list, but we certainly expect Randy Credico to appear on the stand. There's some question about whether he will be allowed to bring his dog. That is actually at the center of one of the charges. Steve Bannon is expected to take the stand. He was Trump's campaign chairman and a close associate of Trump, and just a number of other folks who were in Trump's orbit or Stone's orbit or sort of at the margins of Republican politics could be called as witnesses. And so we'll see. It's certainly, as with everything involving Roger Stone, it's already turned into something of a circus, and I expect that will continue through what we think will be a two-week trial.
Right. And didn't the judge at one point reprimand him and ordered him to be off social media?
Yeah, so most defendants who are facing fairly serious criminal charges go out of their way to avoid antagonizing the judge who's presiding over their case. But at one point early on, shortly after being indicted, Stone posted a photo of the judge with sort of crosshairs near her head and, you know, kind of a menacing tweet that said the fix is in and called her an Obama-appointed judge. And that did not sit well, namely because there's a certain implicit threat there, but also in general, judges do not like the defendant to essentially interrupt the process and allege that he or she is not going to get a fair trial. So she imposed at first a pretty limited gag order on him, saying, you know, Roger Stone is a person who makes his living speaking and giving speeches and being provocative. He's welcome to keep doing that, but he should avoid making comment on anything related to his trial, and eventually just imposed a blanket ban on his use of social media after he continued to make sort of oblique and sometimes even direct references to people involved in his trial. And the judge at one point was pretty exasperated, calling his post middle school behavior and expressing dismay that she had to litigate, you know, questions about his use of Instagram in the middle of what is a fairly serious criminal trial.
Yeah. Okay. As you say, there are lots of rabbit holes here, but is there a connection between this trial and Roger Stone and the impeachment inquiry?
Well, there's not a direct connection, at least not that I'm aware. Who knows what will happen? Trials are always full of twists and turns. But, you know, certainly this will give us a look into Donald Trump's world. You know, he was in contact with Roger Stone. Roger Stone was in contact with a wide variety of characters, some of whom are conspiracy theorists, some of whom are, you know, just sort of ne'er-do-wells at the margins of Republican politics. And what's repeating in the impeachment inquiry is that Trump, again, was in contact with people in the same vein, people pushing conspiracies, pushing misinformation or disinformation, people pushing rumor. And so it certainly will give us a glimpse into how Trump operates, how people around Trump operate, and we'll probably hear from some of his closest associates or former associates like Steve Bannon and Roger Stone.
Okay, it should be eye-opening, at least. Byron Tao covers the FBI and the DOJ for The Wall Street Journal. Byron, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Apple gives billions to make housing more affordable here in California, meanwhile avoiding paying a lot of state taxes. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Apple says it'll spend $2.5 billion to help fix California's housing crisis. That follows billion-dollar pledges from Google and Facebook earlier this year. Some critics, though, say all of this giving is just not enough. Teddy Schleifer is senior reporter at Recode. He covers finance and influence, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, so that sounds like a lot of money, right? $2.5 billion.
It is.
And it seems pretty generous, but Apple makes a lot more than that.
Right. You know, I think the most interesting reaction this yesterday came from none other than Bernie Sanders, who said this was Apple throwing pennies at a problem that they helped create. Obviously, this is not pennies, and, you know, $2.5 billion sounds like a massive amount of money. But given Apple's size and given the scale of the problem, some people could argue it's not actually enough.
Well, it seems the governor was okay with it. He called it an unparalleled financial commitment and that it indicates Apple is serious about solving this issue. Does that indicate that Apple is serious about solving this issue, or does it indicate something else?
Sure. I mean, Gavin Newsom has kind of placed a big priority on getting tech companies specifically to pay more attention to the housing problems in their own backyard. And he's asked try to raise money from tech companies to do just that. And I think, you know, Newsom's kind of position here reflects the fact that Apple is indeed doing something unprecedented with its own money. But I think the scale of the problem here shouldn't be underestimated. And two things can be true at once. Apple can both be digging deep and making a commitment that puts other tech companies to shame and meets Newsom's priority. But you could also argue at the same time, that's not mutually exclusive with it being insufficient to solving the problem.
Right. And so meanwhile, I guess I'm wondering, because Apple is notorious for avoiding paying taxes or avoid paying its
right.
its what it owes if it didn't figure out some creative accounting. So, for instance, it doesn't really pay a lot or any California state tax because it locates a lot of its business in Nevada for tax purposes, even though its products, I guess, are designed and created in Cupertino. But if it did pay state taxes, would it be more than $2.5 billion?
Yeah, I don't actually know the exact numbers there, but that is the argument that this sort of philanthropic altruism, as Sanders called it, sort of misses the point. And obviously, you know, Apple is celebrating this as kind of a much ballyhooed investment in its local community. But, you know, you're right. Apple and frankly other tech companies also do everything within the letter of the law to avoid paying corporate income taxes. And, you know, loopholes do exist. And Apple and Facebook and Microsoft, which are three companies that recently have announced new initiatives to pay for new housing programs in their local communities, all those companies at the very same time are definitely using the law to, as you mentioned, kind of keep assets out of state, out of the country. And that is, in the eyes of some, makes this kind of unparalleled commitment, as Gavin Newsom says, somewhat the second best option, right? You know, mm-hmm. there are some on the left who believe that the best option would be for these companies to pay their fair share in corporate income taxes, and then maybe you wouldn't need a $2.5 billion commitment from the private sector.
What is the role of Apple and these other tech companies in driving up housing costs?
You know, so many of the country's hottest real estate markets are in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there's a reason that coincides with the explosion of these tech giants. You know, you have more and more people moving here who are higher income, who are being paid very, very well, and that tends to price out lower income people. And there's, you know, you've seen the rise in the Bay Area, at least, of sort of these super commuters, people who used to live and work in San Francisco who now live in places like Stockton, California, that are several, more than a few transit stops away from downtown San Francisco. And a lot of that blame, rightly or wrongly, falls on tech companies as sort of the caricature of an economy that has gotten way too hot and has priced out more and more people. You know, I think there's an intellectually honest argument that can be made that too much blame is put on the tech companies, but at least politically, they've sort of become the punching bag for those who think that the Bay Area economy has just gone off kilter.
Yeah. Well, and they've also become a punching bag for all sorts of other things, at least like kind of bipartisan punching bag, actually. And many of the Democratic presidential candidates have talked about breaking up Facebook and some of the other companies and actually taking just a more stringent look at how much power these companies have. Elizabeth Warren talks about a lot of financial power that these companies have and how she's against that. So is this also an attempt to blunt some of that criticism?
Sure. I mean, look, I mean, there is no question that Apple gets a round of positive PR out of this, as every company does. But look, I mean, this is, you know, these companies are on the defensive in a way they've never been before. And to me, you know, I thought Bernie Sanders' comments yesterday sort of spoke to this new the tension between the Democratic Party and big tech moving to new terrain. Right. As you mentioned, a lot of the conversation around these companies has centered on their economic power. You know, whether or not they control too much of the market like Amazon does, or whether or not they have kind of created unfair business practices or treat their employees poorly. Sort of the conversation about their impact on housing has not really been at the forefront of this conversation. But I think as the Democratic Party and these tech giants sort of tangle with each other, we're going to see this move onto new turf. And their impact on housing is something that has sort of been underappreciated And it seems like now, the Bernie Sanders of the world aren't just buying the applause line, so to speak, and they're actually kind of putting new pressure and asking new questions about whether or not these commitments are sort of missing the point.
So why is he the only one saying it, at least so far?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Sanders was, I'll be honest, I myself was a little bit surprised to see Sanders come out for this. I mean, I think a key piece of context here is that the California Democratic primary is much earlier in the cycle than every other cycle past. And that, I think, is going to kind of make this conversation around housing in the Bay Area, not necessarily specific to tech companies, but the Bay Area housing conversation is obviously a key part of local politics. And I think that every politician that's going to be, at least those that will be around by California in March, is going to have some answer on housing issues. So Sanders clearly here sees a way to kind of bind the conversation around tech to the conversation around housing.
Hmm. So I guess I'm wondering if this is becoming linked, like these big, the power that these tech companies have and the high housing costs, if there is anything going on aside from just politicians waiting for a handout from these companies. Are they actually going to try to force these companies to give back some of their money?
Right. Well, actually, next year, there's a major ballot initiative called the Split Roll, which is a measure in California that will be on the 2020 ballot, which basically is trying to remove some of the caps that are assessed on property owned by large corporations in all across California. So that's a way in which, we'll see how that goes. It's going to be a major ballot initiative. Who knows if they'll win? But if successful, some activists think that's the way to actually address housing issues in the state, by basically requiring the Apples of the world to pay more money. That's something that I think, Bernie Sanders has come out in favor of the split roll. So have many presidential candidates. That's a way that would sort of seem to alleviate the need for tech companies to basically dig out of their own pocket. If the split roll was successful, these companies would be paying more voluntarily.
Teddy Schleifer covers finance and influence at Recode. Thanks for joining us.
Sure thing.
Coming up, writer Nick Neely walked from San Diego to Palo Alto, tracing a Spanish expedition from 250 years ago. He slept outside most of the time and almost came upon a mountain lion.
I think it was 30 or 40 feet. It did a call like, Zoe. That's one of their calls. They make a number of different calls.
His story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 250 years ago, the first major Spanish land expedition journeyed across what is now called California. This journey was led by Gaspar de Portola, and he became the original governor of the Californias. Father Junipero Serra joined the trek, and the group established the cities of San Diego and Monterey. They became the first Europeans to see San Francisco Bay. Along the way, they established Spanish outposts and scouted the most fertile land on which to build missions. At those missions, of course, tens of thousands of indigenous people were enslaved. A few years ago, writer Nick Neely set out to follow Portola's route, to walk from San Diego through Los Angeles and up the coast to the San Francisco Bay. He wrote about his journey in a new book. It's called Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. Nick Neely, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why did you want to do this, follow this Portola expedition?
You know, I had always wanted to take a big trek, something like following the Pacific Crest Trail, which is quite famous at this point. Mm-hmm. And so when I learned of the expedition, or relearned of it, really, I thought, what a great opportunity to do something that was markedly different, that would take me through suburban, urban, wild, agricultural areas, and really be an opportunity to entwine natural history, which is my main niche as a writer, with human history, and sort of expand my capabilities and provide something new.
What did you know about Portola before you started this?
Very little. I actually grew up in Portola Valley, which is adjacent to Palo Alto in the Bay Area. And so that was another part of my motivation for this trip. I had grown up there, but I knew nothing about him, and I really knew nothing about the expedition. I'd always assumed they had come over the Santa Cruz Mountains and seen the San Francisco Bay in my town. Turns out that was not true. They had come over those mountains far to the north, near to San Francisco. So this was also a chance to sort of learn the history I probably should have learned in grade school, or at least a little bit later.
And so these guys, these Spaniards, what were they trying to do when they were walking up the California coast?
They were on a mission to find the port of Monterey, which had been, or Monterey at that time, named after a former viceroy of New Spain. And it had been described glowingly by the explorer Vizcaino, who found it by sea. And he said it was an ideal port, and so they wanted to find this port so they could establish a place for ships returning from the Philippines with trade items to stop over. And they were also concerned about alleged Russians trickling down the coast and establishing outposts. So they wanted to claim the territory, and they also, of course, wanted to convert the native populations to Catholicism.
Right. How did you trace their journey? Because it wasn't really mapped out completely. It was really through journal accounts where their journey was described. It wasn't on a physical map, right?
Yeah. Well, there are three journals that were kept on the expedition. The most comprehensive or thorough by the Franciscan padre, one of them that was along with the expedition, Juan Crespi. And historians have used those journals to sort of triangulate where they camped day by day. They really needed water, and they needed, you know, grasses for the horses. They had over 50 mules and as many horses that they rode. So we know roughly where they camped night by night, either, you know, a lake, a river. Historians have, even in downtown Los Angeles, pointed to intersections where their probable camp was. And so I relied on those points and then sort of took the best line from point to point. We can't know the exact line in many cases that they walked, but I was going down the right valleys.
So, yeah, so one of the points, as you say, in Los Angeles was like around the Elysian Valley, like kind of near where Dodger Stadium is.
Right. Yeah, they walked west from the Whittier Narrows, where there's now a giant dam, and came to the Los Angeles River, which they gave name to. In the diaries, Juan Crespi, the padre, calls it Nuestra Señora de Los Angeles de la Porcióncula, named after the little church that St. Francis in Italy was given and repaired. Hmm. And, of course, shortened to Los Angeles, that was quite a doozy of a name. But when he arrived at the Los Angeles River, he described it as looking like an endless field of corn. It was so lush.
So how did you, as someone who likes to be in nature and write about nature, how did you negotiate trying to follow this path and a path that went through some really urban areas from San Diego on up?
You know, it was a real adventure and a refreshing break from hiking in the woods. It was sweltering, of course, at that time of year. I went through Los Angeles in August. In many places in Southern California, I crashed night by night in dry creek beds that's sort of in the interstices of suburbia. In downtown Los Angeles, I stayed in a hostel and I also stayed one night in a hotel. I camped maybe like 5 out of 7 nights on average. So I was careful. I didn't really want to be hassled by others. But I was probably more careful than I needed to be. And no one ever gave me a hard time.
Hmm. In fact, quite the opposite. You talk about meeting people who really helped you. People, even people you thought at first were really scary, like I guess a former gang member or a...
Yeah, everyone was really generous to me. And back to the Bertolo expedition, you know, they never would have made it even close to as far as they did to the San Francisco Bay if not for the unwavering generosity of the tribes and villages that they encountered along the way, who were always giving them food night by night.
And then ultimately, that was kind of the seeds of their own destruction, in a sense, that they were planting.
Yeah, it's true. You know, that was first encounter, and shortly thereafter, the missions would begin to indoctrinate or enslave them, which, you know, I think in many cases it was slavery. And, Yeah, and then, of course, disease is really what diminished the population extraordinarily.
Yeah. And you discovered that a lot of California, or, you know, a lot of the part that you wanted to go through is controlled by the U.S. military or it's private patrolled land like Hollister Ranch.
Right.
And the Hollister Ranch is in the news now because Governor Newsom signed a bill that would open it up, open up the beach access to people.
Right. Yeah. I just heard about that.
Yeah. But it's a private place, which is, so describe Hollister Ranch and how you were able to get through it.
Well, I knew that it would be an impasse for me. I reached out to Hollister and also Coho Alama, which is Coho Alama is adjacent. Both of these are at Point Conception, and that's considered where Southern California turns to Northern. And I reached out to both Hollister and Coho Alama, and they did not give me permission to cross. And so I had invested at that point, you know, 6 weeks of walking. And so I decided I really couldn't detour around this momentous and sort of mythical point. And I decided to walk the train tracks in the middle of the night, which is one of my biggest adventures. I went 20 miles in the dark from 8:30 to 3 in the morning.
Because you didn't want to get caught by the security guards or something?
Yeah, they have private security, and I didn't trespass lightly, you know, and I don't really encourage trespassing in general, but I felt that this project was important and would provide, something important to the public and kind of show them a transect and a landscape that they wouldn't otherwise be able to access. So I took the liberty.
And you weren't caught?
I wasn't caught. I trespassed a number of times, and I was pretty swift and careful.
But you were caught further up north.
Yeah, I accidentally wandered into a snowy plover enclosure. And actually, it's quite funny because walking down that beach, I was speaking into my recorder, which is the way I was taking notes for the most part on this journey. And I was just going on about the birds and describing terns, flying over the water, and really in a kind of revelry. And then I got pulled over, more or less, down the beach. So there was a little bit of an irony there. I had walked into an enclosure. The book, I think, is really an advocate for wildlife. There actually, I name over 70 species of birds along the way. It's kind of a natural history survey of the coast.
Were you surprised at how much natural wildlife and natural life there was in the really urbanized parts of California?
I was. You know, there's growth, there's fecundity everywhere in the crevices of our sidewalks. And, you know, one moment that I remember very vividly, I was camped on a knoll at a place called Tomato Springs or Portola Springs, which is in Irvine. And it's all around it. It's being developed currently. And I was looking out over Irvine and, endless rows of townhouses that had been built behind me were graded fields that would become townhouses. And out of the sagebrush popped a California gnatcatcher, which is a threatened species, flicking its tail right there on the edge of so much density. And it was just a good reminder that, you know, animals come up to our edges and even into our neighborhoods. And that same night, I heard a whole pack of coyotes that were calling to coyotes within the neighborhood. So yes, constantly, there's so much wildlife that I encountered. I even, at one point, heard a mountain lion not far from where I was sleeping. I wasn't entirely sure it was a mountain lion at the time. I thought it may well be, and then the next day I looked it up online and confirmed it. But yeah, I was startled. I was in a sleeping bag. I wasn't in a tent, and I just sort of like bolted upright somehow from lying flat to on my knees.
How close was it?
I think it was 30 or 40 feet. It did a call like, Zoe.
That's what it sounds like?
Yeah, that's one of their calls. They make a number of different calls.
And so as you're going up further north, you pass hundreds of roadside crosses and you walk through mission cemeteries.
Yeah.
And what did that say to you? What did you learn about our history?
I think the trip was really a comment, you know, it really opened my eyes to how violence and kind of devastation and wonder and regrowth coexist side by side. And there was, you know, it was a kind of melancholic trip often to see how the landscape had been changed and to know how people had been displaced and were still being displaced here and there in gentrifying areas. And at the same time, there's just, you know, you can't walk up California and not just be consistently awed by the landscape that is California.
Right. I mean, you could never see what you saw in a car.
No, no. And I actually felt like I was walking became too fast a pace for me. And then I wasn't absorbing the landscape to the depth I truly wanted. I did the best that I could. But yeah, in a car, you do feel when you're driving on a highway, like you're taking it all in. And then as soon as you're walking, you realize, you know, you're just scratching the surface when you drive.
And throughout your trip, you had an escort of sorts, these hummingbirds.
Yeah, they became a kind of mascot for me. I like the word escort. That's a good way of putting it. But yeah, they're everywhere. They love our flowers. They love our eucalyptus trees, which they're one of the few birds that really have benefited from eucalyptus. And so they are now, you know, with us year round. And I saw them almost at every turn. They sing from the tops of trees in our Safeway parking lots. And I saw hundreds.
And they're with you all the way to the end when you end up in Palo Alto.
Yeah, I just have such a fondness for them that I tried to bring them into the book.
I have them in my backyard, so I know they're beautiful.
They're amazing.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Madeline.
That's Nick Neely. He's author of the new book, Alta, California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. Coming up, Apple TV Plus, HBO Max. There are so many more streaming options now. We're going to try to sort it all out for you next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get those.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yoke, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, today we're going to talk about streaming. More than 60 new TV series are debuting just this month. Basically, none of them on broadcast television. Apple TV Plus launched last week. Disney Plus launches next week. On the way, HBO Max, NBCU's Peacock Originals. It is so much content coming our way. Here to help us navigate it all is Alan Sepinwall, chief television critic for Rolling Stone. Hi.
I'm crying just listening to that intro, Madeline. Wow.
You're crying because your job just got a lot harder, basically, right?
It really did. It's just there's not enough hours in the day for me to watch this all, and this is my only job.
Wow. Okay, well, one of the prime reasons for this, I guess, is Apple TV Plus, even though they've only unveiled four television shows, but they're getting tons of attention. You saw those four TV shows. Are they any good?
Not hugely. I mean, you're getting it for only $4.99 a month, which is the cheapest of all the streamers, but you're not getting a lot because there's no library content at all, like you're going to get on Disney or like you get on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or HBO. And the shows, the morning show is very expensive and very boring. For All Mankind, I enjoyed, but mainly because I'm a sucker for stories about the Apollo program and the race to the moon, and it moves incredibly slowly. Dickinson is a mess, but at least it's sort of a fun mess, and it has Haley Steinfeld.
And that's about Emily Dickinson?
Yes, it's about Emily Dickinson, but it's got a hip-hop soundtrack, and all the kids speak modern slang. It's a show that makes a lot of big choices, and only some of them work. And then C, which is this post-apocalyptic something with Jason Momoa in a society where everyone on the planet is blind. It reportedly cost $240 million, and it is
what?
Not good at all. Not
oh
at all.
Oh, my gosh. So is Apple just throwing the whole kitchen sink at this thing, like spare no expense?
I think it's one of these cases. They're way behind the game right now because Netflix has had a head start on everybody for years and years. So even though Apple has dominated a lot of other shares of the market and tech, and everyone's got an Apple device, this particular area they're relatively new to, and they've hired a bunch of TV executives. You know, the two people running the shop right now helped develop Breaking Bad. So it's not entirely, you know, Silicon Valley people, but it's still, you can feel them trying really, really hard to catch up and throw money at the problem. And at least in this early going, you're not really seeing a lot of reward for that.
Well, don't you get it for free if you buy an Apple product? You'll get it for free for a year?
Yeah, but I mean, you've heard the phrase about you get what you pay for. It's just, you know, like if I was a consumer and I got them for free, you're still spending your time to watch them. And
right.
Some of them are okay. Maybe some of them will get better. I don't know. And there's more shows coming up by the end of the month as part of that 60 plus total you talked about before. So it's early goings. You know, AMC launched with Mad Men and Breaking Bad, but not every system is going to be that lucky. So maybe the great Apple show is 2 years away. I don't know.
Okay. Next week is Disney Plus. And like you said, it has the back catalog of Disney movies. Anything else?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you're going to have decades and decades worth of stuff. Every parent I know for the last like 2 months have been talking about how they need to sign up for it because their kids won't forgive them otherwise. But they're going to have, you know, a new High School Musical series. They're going to have the big gun, probably the biggest gun of all these new streamers, is The Mandalorian, which is a Star Wars spinoff that Jon Favreau produced about some Boba Fett-type character out on the edge of the galaxy. I haven't seen it. They're keeping that one under wraps. You know, there's not going to be any kind of screeners until it debuts, but I'm going to watch it. I'm a Star Wars nut, and, you know, there seem to be a lot of us.
Well, so does that mean Disney's taking its stuff off Netflix?
Slowly but surely. So you're going to see a lot of the Marvel stuff on Disney Plus right away, but other things like they have contracts for, and those aren't going to leave. But, you know, what you're going to see, and part of the reason that you're getting all these streamers right now, is everybody wants to own their content and have their content on their particular streaming platform. So that's why, for instance, Friends is leaving Netflix and it's going to go to HBO Max because Warner Brothers owns both of those. You know, it's why The Office is leaving Netflix and I think it's going to wind up eventually on Peacock because NBC owns both of those. It's a whole, everyone just wants to have their own thing. And so you've gone from being able to get by with maybe one or two streaming services, you're going to need like seven or eight. It's basically going to recreate the cable bundle and not save you any money.
Yay. It always seems like the consumer.
I wish I could be more upbeat, Madeline.
It's
maybe The Mandalorian will be great, and I'll be happy about that.
Well, speaking of HBO Max, how does that work if there's already HBO and HBO Go?
Basically, it sounds like it's going to replace HBO Now as a standalone thing. Certain things are unclear. Like, I'm an HBO cable subscriber, and it doesn't seem apparent yet whether I'm going to get HBO Max for free or if I'm going to have to spend extra for that. They're still negotiating some things, but it's basically going to be like the HBO Go or Now app, but with a whole lot of extra stuff. So you'll have Friends, you'll have the Big Bang Theory, you'll have the West Wing, you'll have, you know, a lot of Warner Brothers products. You'll have all of the DC comic shows from the CW. You're going to have some original series that they're making. So it's going to be a lot of different things in addition to having the entire HBO archive, you know, from like Sex and the City all the way through Game of Thrones.
Okay. Now you're making me cry because I'm confused. it's too much.
It's a confusing time. I don't like, I had to write a preview piece about all these streamers for Rolling Stone. And my editors keep saying, well, can you explain this? And I say, no, I can't. Nobody knows the answer to this yet. There's going to be 500 original shows this year and maybe more. So, you know, good luck catching up with it all.
Gee, thanks. Okay. Alan Sepinwall, Chief Television Critic for Rolling Stone. Thank you.
I'm happy to be your ray of sunshine today.
Okay, here's what you can do instead. You can just download and subscribe and listen to the Press Play podcast. Just do that instead. It's much easier, perhaps more satisfying. Listen whenever you want. KCRW.com/PressPlay or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.